Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
The Rich Zeoli Show podcast is sponsored by Mike Venaria Jr. with Osperity Private Wealth.
Hi, I'm Mike Venaria Jr., Wealth Management Specialist. Make your retirement dreams a reality by creating your retirement plan today. Call me at 856-252-0107.
All right, more details coming out about the terror suspect in NOLA and Vegas. And as we speak right now, the Fightin' Irish are up at the half. Welcome back to the show. Glad you're here. It is our fourth and final hour on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT, 855-839-1210 on X at Rich Zeoli. Happy New Year. Hope your New Year is off to a great start. And the question for you is, are you ready to take some personal responsibility? What do I mean by that? Well, let's talk to the man who wrote the latest book, bestseller, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. He is the one and only Dr. Wilfred Riley. Hello, my friend. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Good to be back on the air in 2025.
By the way, what is Dr. Riley's rule on how long you can say Happy New Year?
I'd say maybe 4 days until the start of next week. You can't walk around saying Happy New Year on a Monday, really. I mean, if I had to get the work rules,
too offensive to people who are trying to be sober.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Monday after one of the bigger drinking holidays. Saturday was 2 days ago. You can't cheerfully walk around blowing on one of those kazoos or whatever. So no, it's 4 or 5 day window.
Well, I know that your latest piece at National Review, The Three Holiday Ghosts of Taking Responsibility, excuse me, could not come at a better time, because obviously there's all kinds of people looking to take personal responsibility for things like their health, their drinking, other things. I have a number of friends who are doing Dry January, as it's known. I myself will be partaking in Dry January this year, just because I got to make sure I can, you know, lose a few lbs for the cameras, Dr. Riley. You know, the camera adds 20 pounds, so.
Definitely. I know this myself.
Yeah. Are you doing it as well yourself?
Well, I think I will do Dry January, actually. I toned down when I hit the 40 mark. I used to be a nightlife promoter in Chicago. I was pretty successful, actually. But, I mean, I've really toned down drinking. As an adult male, for a bunch of reasons, there's not really a reason to drink a lot. So, yeah, I'll probably do it. But, no, I was actually making a joke about the camera adding 20 pounds. Like, I mean, I weigh about 200 pounds. So I was just actually joking because I'm kind of chubby. Like, I don't know if it's the camera for me, at least, you know. But that's what everyone says, you know, the camera really tacked on something. Can't put this jersey on because of the camera. You know, so I also have that problem.
Understood. All right, so let's talk about your piece, Personal Responsibility. And actually, I love the way you open this piece. I'm just going to quote the opening line, and we'll get into it here. And it basically says that, now that I hit the reader view, it takes it away. So let me put the reader view away, and I'll just read this. It's always worth remembering that the person responsible for probably 95% of what you do is you. So on that note, Dr. Riley, let's talk about it.
Yeah, so I mean, I recently read an article in Scientific American that looked at all the research on free will, and I was kind of surprised because they lean a bit to the left, but they said, yeah, we basically have free will. I mean, you know, if there's a God, and I think most people would say there probably is, you know, a being that had ultimate wisdom could look at your genetics and could look at your experiences in life and could probably predict what you're going to do. But even that's only accurate about 80% of the time. But more importantly, the being with your genetics and your experiences in life is you. So when people get cynical about this and they make that point, all they're saying is that you do the things that you want to do. So free will is a real thing. You make your choices in life. Of course, they're shaped by who you are and so on. But basic things like doing, quote unquote, CBT, if you drink too much, asking your wife or a buddy or the sergeant to help you dry up. I mean, that's something that almost anyone can do. And so in the piece, I go into just the way we've moved away from taking responsibility. And I kind of link it to the quote unquote woke movement, where we're now applying these excuses, not just to individuals, but to groups. So, I mean, I name a couple of cases. One was this woman, Lily Phillips. I'll keep this PG. But Lily Phillips is a British porn star who recently filmed, let's say, a group sex scene with a bunch of guys. And, you know, I thought this was a little gross. I didn't really have much to say about it at first. But all these feminist women started coming out and saying, there's an article that ran in The Guardian called How Dare These Men Take Advantage of Lily Phillips?
Wait. How the men take advantage of her? I mean, she did this willingly, right?
Yeah. I mean, not only did she do this willingly, she's a female pornographer. She has an OnlyFans page. She made about $2 million from the movie she filmed to this. The guys were just, I mean, like a penis on a screen. They got paid $100 a piece. You know, so, like, she organized the event. She booked the, I'm sure, charming location, you know, motel room, whatever. She brought in a professional, I mean, you're not going to the Four Seasons. You know, she brought in a professional film crew. She took all of the profits. One of the guys ended up getting divorced as a result of this. You can just do your own background research on this. But, I mean, I commented in the piece, like, look, we all want to be gentlemen, but it's absolutely absurd to describe a millionaire female pornographer as a victim for filming porn. You can't just say because women on average make less money than men on average, women who are in erotic videos are victimized by men. That doesn't make any sense. And I went from there to, so like as a woman, you can certainly choose to regulate your sexual behavior and other things in your life, your weight, your relationship with your partner, just like a man can. Equality means equality. And I went from there to the guys. So we saw the Jordan Neely versus Daniel Penny fist fight, then choke out on a train, which unfortunately led to the death of Mr. Neely. And I again, went through all these columns where people were saying things like Jordan Neely was not at fault. He was failed by an uncaring society. And I'm a good researcher. I did 15 minutes of research on that case. And I found that Jordan Neely is a guy who had been given free, fairly high quality housing by the city of New York. He'd been charged in a criminal matter recently. By the way, the criminal case was that he tried to run away with a 7-year-old girl. But he had been sentenced to 15 months of not prison, but outpatient care in a bungalow where they gave him free psych meds. And his response to that was to leave. He left all his pills. He walked away from the place. And he decided he would rather live with his friends in a squat and impersonate Michael Jackson on the train. And after months of doing that and taking drugs and frightening citizens and punching an old lady in the face, breaking her orbital bone, he got in a fight with Daniel Penny and he got killed. And I, again, said the responsibility for this lies entirely on the guy who walked away from his home and walked away from his meds. And while he was on his meds, by the way, while he knew what he was doing, you know, and picked a fight and threatened all these women and kids on the train and ended up dying. And I just went on and on there from there. I mean, I talk about the H-1B thing, the controversy Vivek Ramaswamy started online. I said, you know, Vivek used some harsh language, but let's not pretend that American white and black kids are like the hardest overachievers in the classroom. Like, it's entirely possible to take responsibility for how much you study, how much you practice, so on in life. That was the point of the piece.
Well, I think it's a really important piece. Let's back up for a second. By the way, I should mention that woman you talk about, her goal, and you got to have a goal, to have sex with 1,000 men in a day. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah. So I was being, we've got a lot of ladies in the audience. I was being subtle about the numbers involved. Yeah, Lily Phillips first had sex with 24 men in 4 hours. She filmed a video about that called Doggy Romp. Then she had sex with,
I didn't meaning to transfer it over to digital, but, you know.
Yeah, there's been no reason to, you know, I encourage the guys to take their girlfriend out to dinner rather than watching Mr. Phillips film au revoir, actually. But she had sex with 100 guys. And, you know, by the way, the reason this became the subject of feminist sympathy is that Phillips did this. And she filmed a documentary of it that she sold to her OnlyFans simps, whatever term you want to use. And in the documentary, after doing this, she described herself as sort of like an extreme athlete. Like, it was hard physically there at the end, but I kept going. You know, Lily Phillips doesn't give up. And she looked a little tearful for maybe a minute or two. And a lot of female accounts on Twitter cut that out of context and put it up and said, you know, how could any of these men participate in this? You know, a weeping, crying, innocent woman begging them to stop, kind of this sort of thing. But obviously that's not what happened. But anyway, so Phillips did 101 guys. And now she says she wants to set the all-time sex record, which is apparently a thing. It's currently held by, I think, Houston, the porn star from America. So this British woman wants to take America's throne. And she's... Houston has like 900 something, I don't know. But Phillips has got to beat her. She's got to go well over 1,000.
You know, it's funny to think about, but you back up here and you think about this idea that she's a victim in some way by the paternalistic society. But we've talked about this in the past in the left, which is they're always setting the narrative that there's a victim and there has to always be a victim in everything. Right. I mean, and academia really gets into that in great detail, which is why you wrote your book, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, because it goes through a lot of the people that were the perceived victims throughout history. But there still is that mindset, right? That somebody is, everybody's a victim in one way, shape, or form, and they live their life thinking that. And that's, first of all, got to be a very depressing way to go through life. But on the other hand, there is a whole category of people who are making money off of the idea that, you know, hire me and I can save you from the throes of the victimization that you're going through in society, whether they are the race hustlers or other people.
Yeah, what you just said there, I'd have to unpack some of the books in my library and think about it. But I mean, what you just said there is actually really insightful, that leftists tend to think that in every interaction, someone has to be a victim. And I think that goes back to old Karl Marx. The idea is that the way people get rich is by stealing from other people. And the problem with Marx, as a lot of people have pointed out over the years, is that that's not actually true. You can get rich in 100 different ways. You can get rich from the profits of your own lands. That's feudalism. Well, sort of. I mean, you can also beat your serfs and slaves. I mean, that was just one valid point. But you can get rich from the profits of your own lands. That's agriculture. You can get rich from voluntary exchange and trade. That's capitalism. You can get rich from sailing to other places and exchanging goods. That's mercantilism. So the claim is just wrong. Like, in many exchanges, there is no oppressed group and there is no victimized group. So in, like, the Lily Phillips thing, I don't really see that you have to compare, like, the woman who has the film crew and the armed guard behind her and the guy who's obviously in a dominant position at the time but who easily could be removed from the room and go through this whole haiku and see who's in charge. Like, they're both doing a voluntary thing. So, I mean, when you take something like feminist analysis and you try to apply this to, okay, well, now the women are making a majority of the porn, if you look at OnlyFans, and they're making all the money, you often get kind of a brain-breaking scenario where people kind of say, well, that can't be, does not compute. And then they wind up with something like, well, the demand from evil men in the market is making them do it or something.
Right.
But yeah, the Lily Phillips as a victim thing doesn't make sense at all. Yeah, she wants to set the all-time record. Phillips, by the way, like the whole thing, if you actually read into it, is really weird, but it's more toxic femininity than toxic masculinity. Like the weird corruption of kind of healthy male relationships by an all-female team. Like Lily Phillips' financial manager is her mother, who is a feminist. Like, the whole thing is deeply weird, but it's not a bunch of guys that are pushing her out there and making her do this. So, yeah, that was part of the take responsibility angle.
Dr. Wilfred Riley is with me. The book is Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, but his latest piece over at National Review talks about personal responsibility. I'll come back to the H-1B-1 visa thing, but, you know, since we joked at the start of the interview about weight and the camera and everything else, I've noticed there is this debate that's happening once again, like San Francisco hiring somebody to be the weight czar and this body positivity. And, you know, we're seeing all the commercials now, join this health club, do this diet plan, that sort of thing. And so, you know, inevitably there's about to be backlash. I'm sure there probably already is on social media about how dare we shame people into joining a gym or a health club or a diet plan or anything else. But at the same time, we know that losing weight is good for you. Being fit is good for you. It's healthier. And there's so many reasons to want to do that. But we've also come to this place where some people say that is shaming. You're fat shaming. But we didn't really have this with, like, smoking. Like, everybody agrees smoking's bad for you. We don't shame. Like, it's not like smoke shaming. I mean, I guess there are people that, walk over to you and say, like, yeah, it's terrible, you should quit. But, I mean, like, I'm shamed in the sense that I can't smoke cigars where I want to smoke cigars. But I understand that, and I know cigars and cigarettes are different, but the point of it is there's not, like, a people out there defending cigarette smokers by saying that you are smoke shaming them. Let them smoke and be who they want to be. But yet we do that with weight.
Yeah, the whole thing's really interesting. I mean, I think that the argument is that people who have certain failures, like poverty or obesity, have them because they can't help them, because they're being oppressed by other people. It's all the same BS theory, right? So, like, the reason black people are more likely to be fat is that black people experience racism, and racism causes stress. Now, what a lot of people like the great Tom Sowell and Milton Friedman have been pointing out for about 40 years is that you can just test that. So black people are more likely to live in the South, where all people are more likely to be fat because you have that delicious, ham and cornbread and so on based diet. So if you adjust for that, are black people more obese than white people? As it turns out, no. Sowell pointed this out in Black Rednecks and White Liberals. So then you've taken the theory and you've proven it wrong. But that's a common argument that people just can't help their vices. But I really don't know why the same excuse isn't made for the vices that poor whites or macho Hispanic men or something have. Like, smoking would be one of those. But even, like, racism itself. Like, it would seem that if someone, like some blocky Irish bricklayer was like, yeah, don't like Mexicans much. You know, someone's like, hey, you can't say that. His response could be, you don't understand how I was raised.
Right.
You know, like, I don't... You know, growing up in Charlestown, I mean, the things I saw, the ethnic violence between our schools, like, it seems like anyone could make these kind of frank excuses. And I guess the answer just is communists aren't very good at being fair. Like,
no.
They've identified a couple of things in the papers that came out in the 80s, like Judith Butler, Kimberly Crenshaw, like, weight was one of them, being gay, being black, being female. And those are the kind of the things they focused on. And other things like smoking, being a bit of a bigot, being short, even being Hispanic, those have never gotten the same attention. I mean, there's no reason per se.
Yeah, I mean, my Napoleonic complex, because, I'm not exactly a tall guy. I know that this is radio, but those who've met me in person know that. You know, I mean, I make up for it in other ways, but, I mean, I could blame everything on that. You know, society rewards tall men, and, I'm not tall enough, and there you go. I mean, I could find it and make that an excuse, and, our beauty and all the other things. But that doesn't work. It is interesting what things they allow into the club of the excuse club that you're supposed to just accept people's behavior and vices. The other thing I would say is that the hypocrisy comes out too when you say things like, for example, and we had this debate a while ago, we really don't have it anymore. It's kind of assumed, well, you're born gay, right? You're probably born gay, most likely you're gay, and you don't choose that. However, when it comes to your gender, then somehow the gender assignment committee, which I guess lives in utero, got that one wrong. And that can be changed, even though it can't, scientifically speaking. And that's never been an argument that I've really understood, where it's like, your sexual orientation is set at birth. However, the gender that goes along with that sexual orientation sometimes, that can be changed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the short answer is a lot of these are good points. I'm not sure that there's a lot of coherent, the theory that we're discussing is wrong, basically. Like, I don't think there's a lot of coherent common sense that goes along with it. Like, I'm not sure that people are born conclusively gay or straight.
Well, that's what they say, though. They say that, though, right?
No, yeah, I get your point. It's a good point. But, like, one of the funniest stats I've ever read is that 40% of women and 1% of men identify as bisexual. And just thinking back to, like, college party days or something, I mean, that sounds about right. Like,
yeah.
Men are very unlikely to introduce someone to you as, like, a little more than a friend or something like that. And, I mean, I think this is Mike. We used to play. Like, I think that the reason for that is pretty obvious. Like, female bisexuality is considered cute, attractive. Male bisexuality is not. Your girlfriend might well wonder if you were gay.
Right.
Like, in Chicago or New York, they might wonder if you were a high risk for, say, AIDS. Because there are different things that go along with male homosexuality. Like, are you a gay bottom, she might question. So, like, men are much more likely to say, nope, I am straight, in every society that's ever been studied. Japan, Nigeria, so on down the line. I mean, I think if we were an ancient Greek-style society, you'd probably see the same percentage of men, 20% or something, they would say, under certain circumstances, prison, you know, I could be sexually flexible. So I don't think that there's a gene that determines what you're going to be at birth. And a lot of this, it really comes down to, like, how much of a role activists had getting in there at the very beginning. So, like, the argument of the trans activist is that you're trans if you say you're trans, and that has a certain set of implications. But the argument of the gay activists, ironically, is you're gay if you say you're gay, and that has a certain set of implications. And those two things are diametrically opposed to each other.
They are. But think about this, right? So unpack that a little bit. States will ban gay conversion therapy. So, you know, if somebody who's a minor or even some states adult wants to go, quote unquote, pray away the gay, the left will mock that and belittle that and say, you can't do that. It doesn't work. And they'll actually ban it and they'll say it's child abuse. However, if that same child says, I want to cut off my schwanz and become a woman, then if the parents say no, now that's child abuse. So, I mean, like, it, you know what I'm saying? It's like it's so off the wall crazy in this area. And I don't even know how we got on this subject when it came to personal responsibility, other than to just say it is interesting how there's a set of people who make these decisions and they have lots of implications.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, this is probably last thing from either one of us on this, but the extent to which interested actors, like business lobbyists, who we've probably both met in person, but also, even more so, the representatives of these weird activist groups write the laws is something most people don't know. Like, if there's a bill regulating the treatment of cats, the odds that it was written by strange people from the American Cat Fanciers Association are 100%. And if you ever go to D.C., There's a whole row in D.C. It's the alphabet streets that look like the bar scene in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the embassy from every country. I remember I got lost there once. This is a true story. And, like, the butler in Perfect British Fig at the Pakistani embassy directed me to the Kenyan embassy where there's a guy outside with a shield. Now, everyone inside is wearing business suits, but there are people in this ritual gear. They're like peacocks on the lawn. And you go to the next street, and it's all the different lobbying groups from, like, tobacco to farming with the statues of the thing they're doing in the lawns. And these are the people that write a lot of our bills. And the Human Rights Campaign, which is gay and trans rights, has, I think, an 8-story building with a giant rainbow flag on the side of it right in the middle of this. And that's who's responsible for a lot of this stuff. And if you're just an ordinary taxpayer in Topeka, it seems like magic to you that all this nonsense keeps popping up in the laws and the school books. No, it's individual people with jobs that pay $370,000 a year that live inside the Beltway that are writing it down.
I mean, I had a guest on earlier in the show from Parents Defending Education. And, you know, we were talking about it, since I have the guy who wrote the book, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, the Department of Justice spent over $100 million pushing DEI, restorative justice, and other things in classrooms. And a lot of this was to hire consultants who would push things like queer theory, gender theory, and other theories as well. But to the point you just make, right, there are lobbyists who are pushing these grants, and then grant writers who are hired so that the schools will get the grant money. And then there's people that make the money off of turning around and saying that your children are all victims of a society that does not accept blank, blank, blankety blank.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a real problem. A lot of people don't know how big this is. So, like, when you hear DEI, there was actually, when Chris Rufo started coming out and speaking out against CRT and DEI, a lot of people started trying to brand this as him using weird initialisms from elite law schools. Like Joy Reid, in a funny exchange where they both got some jokes in, said he was talking about critical Rufo theory. But, I mean, the reality is, this is probably 2-3% of headcount in business right now. Almost every corporate enterprise that works with the government is required to provide some kind of diversity statement, so on, before signing that government contract. So I'm not surprised by the 100 mil figure at all. My buddy, who the audience should check out, the writer Brooks Crenshaw, former Navy SEAL, good guy I work out with, but he has this crazy thread right now that's going viral on Twitter about how this impacted the CIA and the Navy Special War Teams, Spec War Teams. There were a certain percentage of female in-field commanders that had to be sent out per orders from on high, let's say right under, you know, the very highest, under the president. And I mean, one of those resulted in a guy we both knew and one of his best friends getting killed. I mean, so this is something that permeates all industries. Like, proportional representation, last sentence, is a principle in U.S. law. We've both been in business, as I understand it. Like, you can get sued if your number of employees in any job category, like tech, sales, marketing, isn't within 80% of the percentage of race X in the U.S. population. So if you have 8% Hispanics in marketing in your IBM, USA is now 19% Hispanic. That's a lawsuit. So they're massive consulting brands that are advising every aspect of the government, every Fortune 1000 on how to do this. So it's a real thing that's out there. The question is, does it provide any utility whatsoever, or should you just hire the best people? It's a heck of a question.
I think we both know the answer to that, my friend. And that's why we'll leave it on that as we start a great 2025 together. I'll post a link to the article, The Three Holiday Ghosts of Taking Responsibility, and get the book if you haven't already, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. Dr. Wilfred Riley, always a pleasure to start the year off with you, my friend. I appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thank you.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk to the guy who wants to be the Republican chairman of Pennsylvania. Why does that matter? It matters a big, big way, big reason. Right now, Notre Dame is winning. As a matter of fact, at the Sugar Bowl, I'm just seeing the score right now, Notre Dame, Georgia. I just hit pause on it, but
Georgia just scored.
Oh, they did? Okay, so what's the actual score right now? I think I'm ahead of you. Oh, 20-10, 9 minutes and 36 seconds left in the third quarter, live at the Sugar Bowl. There you go. All right, as we continue along here in our fourth and final hour on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT, don't go away.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Continue along here. Whatever happened to the pipe bomber in D.C.? New report by the House committee that was looking into that. We'll talk about that as well. And new details coming out regarding New Orleans and Vegas as Notre Dame is in the lead at the Sugar Bowl. Right now, I want to welcome to the show his first appearance on the show, and hopefully it'll be many. Greg Rothman joins me now on Talk Radio 1210 WPHD, and he'd like to become the new Republican chairman of the Pennsylvania State Committee. So, Greg, thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I hope that this is the first of many, and I would love to be back on anytime. I appreciate you and what you're doing and with your show, so thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Ted Christian's a very long, dear friend of mine, and I saw that he's backing you for chairman now since he exited the race, and I think you got
Ted
a lot of great support.
Ted is one of the best. I mean, we are friends beyond just politics. The problem is he's a Mets fan. So besides but I love Ted Christian. And by the way, everybody loves Ted Christian and his party, and we should be grateful for what he did for President Trump going back to 2015. And I think Ted and I met, and we're going to work together. And I think I'm grateful to have his endorsement and support, but more importantly, that he and I are going to work together to try to turn Pennsylvania into a permanently red state.
And that's the key, right, Greg? I mean, this is why this matters. I mean, typically party chairman stuff is kind of inside baseball, but the audience got to know Chairman Michael Whatley very, very well this election cycle. And the chairman was on almost weekly, and actually this is probably the first week he hasn't been on. It's only because I only have one show this week, because tomorrow I'll be at Senator-elect Dave McCormick's inauguration party in D.C., swearing-in party in D.C. So we understand the role of the chairman and how important it is to get people out there and to get them engaged. And Pennsylvania should be and could be a reliable red state going forward that we don't have to worry about if we do the right things now and build on the momentum from this November.
Yeah, I tell people if they want their television airwaves back, in late October and November, like, this is a way to do it. When I, in 2000, if you think about it, and I've been around politics a long time, it was Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania, right? You had to win two of the three. And now, and even 2004, those three were swing states. And now Ohio and Florida are permanently red states, reliable red states. So I think there's a plan. And look, it was Dave McCormick's who first put this in my head about how we could turn Pennsylvania into Ohio and Florida for the upcoming presidential elections. But we also have to beat Governor Shapiro, and we have to win back the House of Representatives. I served there for 7 years. That one vote difference makes Matt Bradford, you know, have the power to set the schedule. And we ought to do something about these judges and the Supreme Court judges, and maybe a retention fight is in 2025. And there's going to be at least three appellate judges that we have to elect, too. So not to mention DAs and school board and local elections. We do need a chairman, which is the chairman I intend to be, that wants to win elections and understands that that's the priority, win the elections. And that's what I've done my political career has been about winning elections. That's where my passion is, and that's where my abilities are.
Well, you know, my friend Val Bianconello, our mutual friend Val, was telling me all about you. And you know, you and I have met years ago, and I know that we were both following each other on X. But for those who don't know you, Greg, tell us about your background and why you want to become the new Republican chairman for Pennsylvania, which I think is probably the most important state, certainly right now, in American politics.
Yep, and Val is one of my heroines or heroes. She's awesome. What she did this past election, what she's done for President Trump and the cause has been great. So I started out in Teenage Republicans. I was inspired by Ronald Reagan in 1980. I ended up being a leader in statewide Teenage Republicans. Went off to, you know, work the polls. I joked that it's true. My parents would let me skip school if I worked the polls on election day. So long before I could vote, I was passing out donuts to the polls in Cumberland County. I went out, went to college in the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is the most liberal college and the most liberal town, the most liberal region of the country. And Jesse Jackson said that, not me. And as a Republican, like, all of a sudden I had to become a conservative because I had to defend why I believed what I believed. And so for 4 years of high school and 4 years of college, that was Ronald Reagan's two terms. And defending Ronald Reagan, being inspired by Ronald Reagan. And then eventually I got to go to Washington and worked for the United States Senate Steering Committee, 25 conservative senators on the Reagan agenda. And that was pretty exciting, too. And then in 1988, I met, by the way, Guy Shirocki from your area in 1986 in the College Republicans and helped get him elected to the National College Republican co-chairman. And in 1988, I took a semester off of college to go work for Jack Kemp. And I was an advanced man and a youth coordinator for Jack Kemp, traveled the country. The guy who taught me how to be an advanced man was Lanny Wiles, whose wife is Susie Wiles, the new chief of staff to the president.
Wow.
And look, that was an experience of a lifetime, being in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Georgia and Florida and traveling with Jack. And that turned me into a supply-side, free market, free enterprise conservative. But it also, you know, having getting ready to graduate from college, I rushed back to finish college in time because Jack wasn't vice president, which I thought he'd be. And I decided to come home and be a conservative. And so I came back to Central Pennsylvania and started in a family business that I helped to grow, a real estate business that we just celebrated our 55th year. I started a family. I've got five kids, including four girls. So I'm an expert in diplomacy. And I got involved in my church. I taught Sunday school for 20 years. I was involved in youth group, helping the youth group. And then I did, you know, what the most proud thing I've ever done in my life. When the ground war started, the first Gulf War, I joined the Marine Corps. And I would end up spending, that war ended in 4 days, so they didn't really need me. But I ended up spending 10 years in the Marine Corps Reserve, about 40 days a year going to Reading, and did get to go to Norway, did not see combat, which, you know, it was a relatively peaceful time, but partly because we had, were strength. It was peace and strength, but we also had Bill Clinton as our commander-in-chief, which was, you know, made me sort of stay away from politics. And then in 2004, I got back into politics to work on the Bush campaign, and I was eventually a Bush appointee to his National Veterans Business Development Corporation. Rick Santorum, who had been a friend of mine from Young Republicans back in the 90s, would ask me to help him run for Senate in 2006, which we lost. But then that would lead to me traveling around the country with him when he ran for president. I was the oldest body guy in politics. I was his body guy. And a lot of times it was just the two of us. So it wasn't hard to be. I was his driver and his valet and his the New York Times called me his best friend in chief. But after that campaign in 2012, I got the bug, and not the bug. Like, I just felt like, you know, you should run, Greg. Like, you need to be, put your name on. I was a donor and I helped organize, but so I ran for state committee and actually got elected to state committee. And then I ended up becoming the Cumberland County Republican chairman. And I will tell you, the hardest job in politics is being a county chairman. It's a thankless, full-time grind. There's always a quarter of the people that are mad at you. And, but it's a necessary job, and I did that for three terms. And my state rep left to take another job. There was a special election, and I ran for the state house and got elected. I ended up having, I think, seven contested elections in 7 years. And Matt Bradford and the Democrats liked me so much that when they did redistricting, they blew up my house seat. They put it in five different places. And so I had run the HRCC under Mike Tozai, and we actually picked up three seats and won three special elections during my term. And so, I was a leader on every conservative issue in the House. Even though I was in a suburban Republican district, I was a leader on endorsed 100% by the NRA and gun groups. I was endorsed by the Pro-Life Federation. I fought the COVID draconian regulations.
Thank you.
Tom Wolf. My first bill I introduced was to cut the corporate income tax, which ended up becoming law. I don't know if your listeners will appreciate this or not, but my bill to get rid of the alternative fuels tax and create a EV fee for electric vehicles. Now I like Elon Musk, so I'm not sure about that bill. But, so I fought on conservative ideas in the House, and then, you know, with a Senate seat, there was a new Senate district. I decided to run for the Senate and ran, had a contested primary, and won the Senate seat. So, and then last year I worked on the SRCC to help us win elections, the one we're most proud of course. We kept all of our incumbents, but we won that Philadelphia seat. I should say Joe Bicozzi won that Philadelphia seat.
Yeah, Joe's great.
He worked so hard for that. So I feel like I've had every experience you could have to put you in a spot to be a good party chairman. I think that the party is a four-legged stool. So you have the activists. I've been an activist. I mean, I knocked on 20,000 doors in my last election by myself. I've worked polls. I've done lit drops. I understand why grassroots activists are so important, and I believe in it. And but I've also been a donor and have raised lots of money, millions of dollars for the Republican Party. I know how to ask.
It's the mother's milk of politics.
Absolutely,
got to raise the money.
And I know how to ask, because I've given it myself. I know I would give it to candidates because I didn't want to have to run myself.
Yeah.
And then I think the third leg is the party, and to have been a teenage Republican, college Republican, young Republican, county chair, state committee member, I get at HRCC and SRCC, I really get how important the party is. And then finally, the candidates. I mean, they're without candidates, we don't win elections or even have elections. And I know how to recruit, and because I've been one, and I've been a successful candidate. So that's what I'm trying to take to the state committee. I think this is a unique opportunity. We changed the course of history, but now we have to stay on that course. And I'm thrilled to have the support of Senator-elect McCormick and many of our party leaders and most of our elected officials in the state and Senate, because they know me well. And so I've been telling people I'm being supported by people who know me, and the people who aren't there yet just haven't met me yet. So.
Good. Well, Greg, listen, I'm very happy you're doing this. And I'll tell you, I was a county chairman myself on the Jersey side. It is herding cats. It is a thankless job, but it does give you great experience in managing the factions that we do have to all come together, especially after primaries, and being able to do that and get everybody back together again, because that's the only way to win, is crucial. And so, you know that firsthand, and that's key, because we're, you know, as long as we're an open, free party, we're not like the Democrats, we'll have primaries, we'll have battles, we'll have all those things. But it's picking up the pieces and rebuilding and then going forward to November to win, which is also critical. And I know you know to do that as well. Well, listen, I wish you the best of luck. I believe this is the start of a beautiful friendship. So count me as one
Excellent.
Of those people who's on your side, and let me know what I can do to help you.
Thank you, Rich. You have a great night. Enjoy Washington, D.C. Maybe I'll run into you down there.
Look forward to it, Greg. Thank you very much.
Take
Greg
care.
Rothman, future chairman. Appreciate it, buddy.
The Rich Cioli Show.
on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right, so the speaker fight, speaking of herding cats right now on Capitol Hill, Mike Johnson, the current speaker, will he survive? We'll talk about that. New details coming out of NOLA. The Irish still in the lead, Justin. I didn't check the score because I was listening to Greg.
Yeah, it's still 20-10. 2 minutes, 55 seconds left in the third quarter.
This is the most football I've ever watched, college football, in my life. Look at that. No, that's not true. I used to go to all the Terps games when I was there. Come on. Come on, man. Terps games. Go Terps. It's a long time ago, though, but, you know. All right, you want me to break here? Speaking of basketball, Bob, speaking of college, we've got a basketball game on at 7, right?
Yeah, yep. Penn State.
All right, so I'm going to take a quick break?
Yes.
All right, take a quick break, come back, and then don't go away.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I'll tell you what, there's a lot of questions around the pipe bomb. It was discovered allegedly outside the RNC and the DNC on January the 6th, and I just saw they posted a picture of who they believe is the person of interest. But, you know, I look at my friend Julie Kelly, who's been all over this stuff, and she's been on the show before, of course, and she says that if you look at the videos of the discovery of the pipe bomb of the device near the RNC, you'll note how Carlin Younger, who just happened to spot the device about 20 minutes before the joint session convened at 1 p.m., calmly walked back to her apartment, and they never moved the vice president. And she points out that the FBI and the new House report that's out into the unsolved January 6 pipe bombs reveals a once vigorous FBI investigation stopped in early 2021, despite initially devoting massive resources into finding the suspect. Now agencies are refusing to cooperate with the House inquiry into this. And by the way, Liz Cheney was just awarded the Presidential Medal for putting the American people over party. And I do think it's interesting how Julie observes the sustained applause by the same D.C. establishment types who wanted her father hung at The Hague, charged with war crimes, is just astonishing. But nothing adds up about the January 6th pipe bomb. Nothing. It was a completely calm response to the device being discovered with the incoming vice president and sitting United States Senator inside the building. It's just there's a lot off here about all this. So the House committee is being stymied right now. I imagine that's going to change come January. Oh, and speaking of that, by the way, so future President Trump put the following statement out on Truth Social. Our country is a disaster, a laughingstock all over the world. This is what happens when you have open borders with weak, ineffective, and virtually non-existent leadership. The DOJ, FBI, and Democrat state and local prosecutors have not done their job. They are incompetent and corrupt, having spent all of their waking hours unlawfully attacking their political opponent, me, rather than focusing on protecting Americans from the outside and inside, violent scum that has infiltrated all aspects of our government and our nation itself. Democrats should be ashamed of themselves for allowing this to happen to our country. The CIA must get involved now before it is too late. The USA is breaking down. A violent erosion of safety, national security, and democracy is taking place all over our nation. Only strength and powerful leadership will stop it. See you on January 20th. Make America great again. I don't know the CIA part. I'm not exactly sure what he means by that. But nevertheless, he just put that statement out a short time ago as well. And he also put out the following statement. With the Biden open borders policy, I said many times during rallies and elsewhere that radical Islamic terrorism and other forms of violent crime will become so bad in America that it will become hard to even imagine or believe. That time has come, only worse than ever imagined. Joe Biden is the worst president in the history of America, a complete and total disaster. What he and his group of election interfering thugs have done to our country will not soon be forgotten. Hashtag MAGA. So there you go. But anyway, see what comes of that. The suspect, the FBI says the suspect in New Orleans was 100% inspired by ISIS. The guy on the Vegas side, they say is not, there's no relation to the two. They don't think. Obviously, with that guy, I have my doubts about everything you're saying, but he blew up a Tesla exploded a Tesla Cybertruck right outside the Trump Hotel. So probably was giving a political statement, obviously. And hundreds of call for an intifada at New Year's anti-Israel protests in Times Square. So there's with the inauguration coming up in January, you can imagine that people are going to be very, very concerned about things. There's real question about why New Orleans took down those anti-vehicle barricades ahead of the Sugar Bowl. When you think that it's a massive event that's going on in New Orleans now. And New Orleans in general for New Year's is just a massive event, too. They said they were doing it because they were getting the city ready for the Super Bowl. I don't really understand. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But never underestimate Democrat incompetence in these cities. Really, truly, never underestimate it. But they say that the suspect, even though yesterday they told us he probably had help, today they're saying he worked alone. And there's all these videos surfacing of him. I guess he was a real estate agent in Texas. And he would put all these videos on about how to be successful in real estate and discipline and everything else. And on the speaker fight, Mike Johnson is claiming he's going to win on the first round of voting tomorrow. He has called, according to the New York Times, every single House Republican over the holidays. He says he has the votes of everybody except for Tom Massey. He can't afford to lose another vote. But he's saying he's going to do this and he'll do it on the first round. So we'll see. That'll be tomorrow. I won't be on the air tomorrow, but Mary Walter will be in. So you'll have a great show with Mary, and RNC Chairman Michael Whatley will be joining her. So hopefully he'll give some clarity if there is, in fact, a speaker fight going on. But I do see that our friend Scott Perry right now is speaking on Fox News, and he's saying that he thinks right now that Mike Johnson has done under tough conditions. He's going to keep his options open, though, he says, at the moment. So that's what our buddy Scott Perry is saying. He's keeping his options open at the moment. All right, Penn State basketball is coming up tonight, but keep the conversation going on X at Rich Zeoli. I'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend. Thank you for listening.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.